Hey, Film Wax Radio welcomes back the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Film program to the show. The Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Film offers a two-year student design, project-driven graduate program of professional mentorships for your scripts, fiction and nonfiction filmmaking, and hybrid and transmedia projects. Each semester begins with an on-campus residency week of screenings, workshop lectures, and crits, along with preparation of an independent study plan for your own personal projects. Then, students and faculty return home to work independently and meet monthly via Skype as projects unfold. The MFA program is designed to fit into the life you have and the films you make. Exciting, affordable, and intense, refine your creative vision as you develop intensely personal stories in an independent practice. Visit vcfa.edu/film for more details. And now, on with the show.
Hello, this is Hal Hartley, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, episode number 425 of the podcast. And on this episode, I'm going to be celebrating two new documentaries. You know, I have that special penchant for documentaries. One is called School Life, and the other is called Trophy. And I really enjoyed both of these, and I hope to bring these to the attention of as many people as possible so people go out and support innovative, beautifully filmed, great, exciting, sometimes complicated and disturbing, but always interesting documentaries. That's the idea. And I think School Life seems, you know, very low-key and charming on the surface, but there's more below the surface, whereas A Trophy is hard sometimes to watch. It's a jagged pill of a film, as I call it during the conversation, but it has much more to it, and it certainly will spur many really important conversations about what it is to hunt and conserve animals. They usually have been two concepts that have been up against each other, and now that's not the case anymore. We're going to explore that in the first segment today. First up here is the co-directors of Trophy, Shaul Schwartz and Christina Clazeau. And they together are both, even though Christina, for instance, from the Midwest, and Shaul is from Israel originally, but for many years, both have been living and working out of Brooklyn. So they're local filmmakers, and they have a new film again. It's called Trophy, which is a startling exploration of the evolving relationship between big game hunting and wildlife conservation that will leave audiences debating what is right, what is wrong, and what is necessary in order to save the great species of the world from extinction. The film opens here in New York City on September the 8th and is being distributed by The Orchard. We'll get into that conversation with – it's difficult because it's a conversation about conservation. And so we'll get into that in just a moment with the filmmakers Shaul Schwartz and Christina Clazeau. And then we'll come back. I'll say hello. How's it going? Are you still – listening to the show, and we'll get into part two, the second documentary called School Life with those filmmakers. Okay, so please stay tuned for the entire show, okay, and we'll get into part two right after that. So here we go. Let's start with Trophy. Here's a little bit of the trailer leading into the conversation. Here only, by the way, on Filmwax Radio.
I've been a hunter my whole life. I lost my dad a few years ago, and he was a hunter. And I think that he would be really tickled to be able to tell the people back home at the coffee shop that his son is out hunting a lion.
The Safari Club International show is the largest hunting convention in the planet.
Crocodiles are really mean. Besides that, I want a pair of boots.
Poachers will shoot every last one because there's a commercial-driven desire.
people are confused how hunting and conservation go together.
You can just pick whatever animal you want from the menu that they offer you, see the price, and book the kill.
Big cats in 21 and 22, sold!
And that money will all go back into conservation.
How much for that sucker?
35. I'm talking with Christina Clajo and Shaul Schwartz, the co-directors of a new documentary, which is probably going to be, I'm going to guess, if it's not outright controversial, I think it's going to engage a lot of people in animated conversations, because I'm sure it's already been happening a lot, right? Which, yeah, mostly at festival screenings or whatnot, but hi, Christina.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
If you detect any accents at all, I don't know if you will. You're from the Midwest, though.
I'm from the Midwest.
Right? And, mm-hmm. and then, so there's that.
Yeah.
And you're living in Brooklyn now, right? Okay. And Shaul is originally from Israel, but
I'm originally from Israel, and I live in Brooklyn for the last 20 years.
Oh, for 20 years? I didn't know it was that long.
I'm American now. What can I say?
Yeah. And then, yeah, that's right. We have Susan Organ in the room, who's Canadian American or North American. We're all Americans. Canadians are Americans. You can say what you want, but North America makes you an American. It's a rabbit hole. Anyway, let's talk about the film, because it's called Trophy. And yeah, if you were beginning to talk a little bit about maybe some of the conversations after the films, why not start there? Because then we can dive deeper into the actual subject matter.
Yeah, I think we made this film to create conversation about conservation, and we
that's a tongue twister.
Yes, that got me. But yeah, you know, we walked into this subject, particularly me being from Israel, mm-hmm. very, very anti. Did not remotely think that putting commercial value on animals could in any way benefit them. And as we kind of drew ourselves deeper and deeper in this world, we understood that this is a main point that we want to portray. And so we gave voice to those who actually believe in if it pays, it stays model, meaning if you put commercial value on an animal, can it actually help conserve it? And usually that gets you a heated debate. People don't like that. It's not a comfortable thing to think of. And I think we're happy that it makes people slightly uncomfortable, because the interesting thing about this very polarizing subject, which is not true for other polarizing subjects, is that we all want to get to the same place. Meaning hunters, hunters say they're animal lovers, but animal welfare organization, we're all trying to create a reality where elephants, lions, other species live in this world in 20, 30, 40, 100 years. But we sharply disagree on how to do that. And so that's kind of the conversation we wanted to create with the film.
You know, we've been screening this since January in film festivals. And it's interesting because one of the challenges we've been facing is to get people into the seats to watch the film. It's hard when you talk about animals being hurt or killed in a movie that everybody's just like, no, I don't want to pay attention to this. But once people do come and see the film, it's really enlightening what the conversations that come out of it. And I think that's important, because I think people come in with their own ideas and preconceived notions of our relationship to animals and what they believe is right. And more times than not, people leave with many more answers and many more questions than they anticipated they could go in those directions. And I think that's really important.
And I think just to add one little point to that, it kind of pisses me off sometimes when people say, I love animals, so I can't watch this. If you care, you should deal with stuff.
I agree.
But it happens all the time.
I understand, I think it's important. Well, it's difficult for animal lovers too, though, because, you know, I mean, legitimately, I could see why you could say that somebody who just is not inclined or refuses to watch a documentary where animals are harmed or don't want to get muddied into the conversation by, you know, all the different perspectives that you have to listen to if you're watching it. You know, there people have the right to also to. But I do agree that I am an anti-gun person. You know, I could easily say that without any kind of ambivalence. Mm-hmm. But I felt it was important to have the experience of shooting a weapon, shooting guns, so I would understand what the appeal was. I mean, I kind of understood it, but I should actually try it. So I'm not going to go out there and get a lion trophy. But
neither are we.
I guess what disturbs me about, again, I'm glad for the opportunity to be disturbed and to kind of want to talk about it. So that I have your film to thank for that. But that, you know, as long as we had the term conservation, animal wildlife conservation, it pertained to a particular thing. And now, you know, hunters now realize they can co-opt the word to fit what they're doing. And I guess that's what I have the trouble with. It's almost like this this whole, you know, time we're living in is very much about multiple versions of the truth, which bothers most of us, right? And in a way, I feel like all that the hunters have done is co-opted the language in order to fit what they're doing. And I you know, it's I don't believe you just because you're farming wild animals in order to then kill them, you know, it's that's not really conservation at its purest definition, you know. Thank you, Susan, for going. Oh my God, careful! They make scalding coffee at those places.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. I don't know. Has that come up much? Like just the kind of co-opting of the language to sort of.
Yeah,
make
look,
a case for what you're doing.
Conservation costs money. That's probably something that's everybody on this could agree to dialogue, right? It's, for example, estimated that if you want to conserve Africa's wildlife, it's going to cost about $2 billion a year. Money doesn't just rain, unfortunately, and there's a couple of ways to get that money. And part of the ways is these solutions that these people are proposing that are not so comfortable.
Yeah.
While farming animals is not the purest conservation, not all of them pay with their lives. For example, John Hume, that has a rhino farm, is suggesting...
He's one of the lead subjects in the film.
One of the lead subjects in the film, the world's biggest rhino breeder, is suggesting a model where we legalize the trade in rhino horn, trim the rhino horn off, it grows back, it's made from the same material that our nails are made out of.
Is that right? So why don't the Chinese just...
You know...
That's controversial, too.
That's controversial, too. But the thing is, we try and understand, and this happened to me going into the film, we try and understand why would somebody want a lion over there? Why would somebody...
Oh, right, that.
Why would somebody want to inhale rhino horn? And I suggest we do that less because the fact is they've been doing it for thousands of years, and they'll probably continue to do it. The
well, we've been doing a lot of things for thousands of years, you know.
The real question is, can we use that as a driving force?
Right.
Because right now the rhinos are going extinct. They have about 10, 15 years left.
We're down to 350,000.
Elephants, 350,000. There's less than 30,000. We're probably closer to 25,000 rhinos. So, you know, we're losing them at a drastic rate.
Really?
They're being poached at over 1,000 a year in South Africa.
Right.
Not looking good.
The film looks into all these points we're bringing up in great detail in terms of the nuance of these things. You mentioned John Hume, who's, by the way, you know, he made his fortune on real estate, right, selling in South Africa, right? And he loves the rhinoceros. You know, it's funny how your movie starts with almost like a spoiler, talking about the horns and what he does, because I started watching within the first seconds. I'm like, after the opening sequence, I think it starts with a father and a son. And then it goes into, shortly thereafter, into John Hume. The screen. You don't know who they are.
So, kind of a spoiler because it looks like a hunt.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh, I'm not watching this. These bastards, you know, as they're like, you don't know what they're going to do. And then it turns out he, you know, this is actually his way of trying to preserve or conserve the animal. So it's really, to talk about it is a little bit
Yeah, I mean, I think
tricky.
when we first started the edit process of this, we, in a way, wanted to anger everybody. What side you're on didn't matter. We wanted to almost shock you in a way, a small way, a big way, and then kind of flip it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really apparent in the John Hume, is that you come off a hunt and you go into what seems like another hunt, and then you quickly turn it around and say, wait, that solution that you just saw with Philip and his son, mm-hmm. or that incident, is not the same here. It's interesting with John Hume because I think we were initially introduced to him as this greedy, profiteering individual, and it's not what we saw at all.
I have the recipe to save the rhino from extinction. Sell the horns, keep the rhinos alive.
On the black market, the retail value of this horn would be $250,000.
The operation, it's painless. It'll take 2 years before he goes through the same procedure again. All I need is for it to be legal. Give me one animal that's gone extinct, while farmers were breeding it and making money out of it. There's not one.
You know, he's invested $50 to $60 million into the Rhino Project with no return.
Of his own money, right?
With his own money and no return on that investment. Right. And his real goal is to conserve the rhino. And I think we think about, you know, they're decimating the rhinos, 1,000 a year in South Africa alone, 3 a day in the Kruger Park. And the solution we've been doing so far is not working. And so to kind of bring that early on into the film was kind of setting this precedent that throughout this film, we're going to kind of shake you. We're going to show you one thing and then turn it on its side and show you something else.
Right. And you may not like it or you may like it. You never know.
You may. And I think there's a big misconception with the rhino horn alone is that people don't know that it grows back. And I think that's a big thing. It's that
takes about 2 years for it to grow back
fully. Yeah. He trims it every 2 years.
Right. And then it discourages, he can sell it, and so therefore it puts out the poachers out of business.
Yeah, and actually the selling, he just recently was able to secure, you know, the legalization of trade within domestic market of South Africa. Prior to that, there was a moratorium, so he couldn't sell it. So he had been just stockpiling this horn for the last, since 2009, and wasn't able to sell it, so he was just investing into his project, but not being able to even support his project.
Yeah, and I think the key here is that the argument is that people say, oh, why should he make money off this? Yes, he wants to make money, but more importantly, he wants to prove if you make money off something, then a lot of people are going to breed it. Right now, people are killing the rhino for its horn for one time. By the way, it's legal to hunt the rhino in South Africa.
Why isn't he franchising?
Well, because it's not legal. The point here is that if
rhinos?
You have an economic model, then people give a shit. They're going to do it. They're going to breed, and they're going to protect rhinos.
Sure, sure.
If it's illegal, they're going to whack it.
Right.
They're going to treat it like a disease, because if you had a rhino and you're South African, it attracted the bad guys to come shoot the rhino and maybe you. Mm-hmm. And if we flip that model and say, hey, this generates money for farmers, which is a proven thing beyond the rhino, then people will want to look after it. And so there's a cynical way to say, oh, let's not touch it. Let the wild be wild. Why should we put value on these animals? And I'm fine if you think that. I fought that. But I've dared challenge that, and I dare you to come in and challenge that, because at the end of the day, economic models prove to work, and they can't work in conserving animals.
The conversation has always been about conservation versus hunting, and what the film Trophy does is it removes the verses. The film is about hunting and conservation and hunting, that the two aren't any longer,
separate
or adversarial in every way, you know. And this is largely achieved through your characters or your subjects. We mentioned two. You have John Hume, again, who with the rhino guy, the rhino horn guy, and Philip Glass, who's a big game hunter. His dream is to, I think, right,
hunt
to get
the
all
big
the big five, which are the big five,
lion, leopard, elephant, buffalo,
and the arc. I think it's the
rhino,
and the rhino. Sorry. Okay, very good. I was going to throw in a joke. But anyway, and then, you know, so, and through maybe one or two other people, there are about two other or three other people, and through following them around and through, you know, talking with them, we get all these nuances that we're discussing. They become a lot more sort of teased out and clearer, like all the different parts of this complicated issue. So by the end of it, you might actually have a perspective on that that you can call your own, potentially.
Yeah, and I think looking at conservation as a whole, I think there are many ways to conserve animals, and I don't think we're saying that hunting is the only way.
Mm-hmm.
It is a part of it, and I think there's other ways too. Breeding is a way. All of these things are a way. Donating money, reserves, everything, tourism. And I just think we've gotten so far to realize that, like, hunting is not a part of that solution, that it is kind of strange and counterintuitive for you to say these hunters are hunting these animals in order to conserve them. But a lot of times this is a model that works. And South Africa is a really good example that, you know, there's a lot of ranches. It's privately owned.
So you're allowed to farm.
You're allowed to
farm. There you can farm whatever you want.
And the thing is that back, 30, 40 years ago, a lot of these private owners were only breeding cattle, and they realized they could make more money off of game. And so what they were doing is breeding game, and in turn, there's more game than there was 30 years ago.
Right. Also, are we that worried about it when they're not extinct? I mean, is it the extinction itself which makes everybody all worry? All of a sudden, we wait, and then all of a sudden they become extinct, and now we're kind of panicking. Because before then, I don't remember that I guess you're not conserving if it's not extinct.
I think that a lot of these larger animals that these majestic creatures are the ones that we're concerned about, because we from the West look at the elephant as Dumbo or a lion as Lion King, and it's this perception.
Well, but they're still
there's a lot of other animals out there that are also going extinct that we don't necessarily.
That's right.
One good example is a vicuna, which is a small furry wool animal that went down to where I think there was 5,000 left in the world, and when in Peru. And when the local people decided to farm these animals and shave the wool instead of killing the animal, the numbers rebounded, and now there's
400,000. They're off the extinction list. So. It does bring up this a couple of new things you just brought up. One is, of course, us over here in the West, in the States, we don't have wild animals.
Well, we have a lot of wild animals. We have deer. We have.
Oh, excuse me. I misspoke. We don't have the majestic kind of wild game that we're looking
at. Sure,
we're not jungle animals. Okay.
But what
we have deer.
Do
we do have deer, and when they overpopulate, we just extend the hunting season. We seem to have less of a moral problem with it. And then it goes into the whole animal rights, which we're going to stay away from because, that's just...
No, but something you said, we have less of a moral problem. That's an interesting way to put it, because I think most of us are so distant from having a real relationship with animals beyond our pets, that we almost kind of tend to forget that the burger we eat is a cow, and it got slaughtered, and it got raised in a certain way, and so is the bacon, and so is the leather, and so on and so on. And I take fault in that too. Like, it's pretty easy to forget, right? We just don't take part in that. But honestly, we get really upset about people killing animals, but we partake lot.
Okay. Well,
totally live off that. I disagree with you. We completely live off that without growing.
Tigers?
No, cows?
No, I'm saying we do off of that. I mean, there are people that can make an extinction. Those who don't choose to be vegan, for instance, live a vegan lifestyle. They can, those who don't,
to some degree,
can say, we eat.
I give vegans a lot of credit, because at least it was hard for me making this movie, because I always felt part of the chain, because I do use animals.
Sure.
If I was vegan, I'd be like, you know what? I chose differently. I have a moral right that you don't, because you're part of it in some way.
Yeah.
Do I eat elephant? No.
Right.
I eat cow. But still, to some degree, we've distanced that from us. We like not thinking as being part of it, but we are, most of us that are not vegan.
Right. Even that demographic is represented in one protest in the States. There is in Vegas every year there's an annual convention which actually is like kind of the infrastructure for the whole gaming and safari culture.
So there's a convention once a year usually in Las Vegas that houses 30,000 people come through there, and it's called the Safari Club International Convention. Mm-hmm. And there you can buy your hunt, you can buy your clothing for safari,
you can ensure
your trophy with AIG, and it really attests to how the big game hunting market has grown exponentially in a capitalist way.
Right. And so I think it was during one of the scenes during that. I mean, you may have shot. Did you just shoot at one of those conventions?
Oh, two years.
It looked like that. Yeah, and I think at one of them there was a protest, right? And so
there was a protest.
The actual animal rights activists didn't come off as great in the context. I'm not saying that they were wrong. I'm just saying
Yeah, I think sometimes I think animal rights activists mean well. And I think they do a lot of good things. But I think at times, there's a lot of animal rights activists that don't provide a very concrete solution. And I think
it's sort of black or white. And then you may be cutting off your nose despite your face, in the sense of that. Are they in the bigger scheme of things adding to the problem
rather than the solution? And I think that's a hard thing.
It's hard, right.
you know, that I think they do mean well, and I think they try and they have the solutions that they believe are right. But I think a lot of animal rights and welfare groups say they want this animals just to be alone in the wild, and they'll preserve themselves like they've done millions of years. And the reality is it's a really utopian idea because of loss of habitat, human encroachment, human wildlife conflict, all of these things that play in. It's very separate from our view of animals in the West versus those on the ground there. And I think unless you can bring that into the fold and into the conversation, it can be almost more detrimental than useful.
So we've been talking for like 20 minutes about this complicated conversation. I'm wondering, you hired a great publicist for this project, because how do you couch this film in a way that you're going to get people to come out and be okay? Because, you know, it's a jagged pill, let's put it that way. I'm not going to say it's a hard film to watch. It's a beautiful film to watch. It's very cinematic. You know, you did a wonderful job. It looks beautiful.
I think people think it's more hard to watch than it actually is.
Maybe
I
so.
Think people,
well, yeah.
I think people are fearful of the subject, and I, again, dare challenge them to say, if you care, then you should watch, because if you don't, you know, so is City of Ghosts, a great film about Syria. It's very hard to watch, but if you care, you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that's kind of the essence of difficult subjects. We dare tackle them.
Yeah.
We did all we can to make this film approachable to everybody. I think we take everybody's perspective serious, and we dare kind of give you a view on it that's not been taken before. I've seen a lot of films in this niche that have decided to end with a 1-2-3 statement of this is how to solve it.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a 1-2-3 statement how to solve it. I think our world does that way too often today, and it's costing us heavily. So we didn't want to dumb down this subject, and we really hope the viewer takes a bigger dive into it.
Well said. Trophy is opening in New York and Los Angeles? Same day?
Trophy opens in New York on September 8th and in Los Angeles on September 15th.
On the 15th.
And then nationwide.
And then, yeah. Okay. And where is it playing in New York, Susan? Where is it playing?
At the Quad Theater.
The Quad Cinema.
Quad Cinema.
Going to have the, it's cinema. Come on. It has, I'm getting Charles Cohen on here in a few days. He owns the most of the Manhattan real estate. He's executive producing a documentary, but it was a way in. But I was curious to know about that, about, you know, how a real estate developer, like another real estate developer, how he ends up owning, you know, an independent art house cinema. Anyway, The Orchard, again, is the distributor, which only matters to my listeners. And it's going to be, again, at Los Angeles on the 15th, and then hopefully much wider over the weeks to come, right?
Yes.
Thank you, guys. It's been great meeting you both.
Thank you.
Yeah. I wanted to get into, what was it, the organization they worked with? That's one of them. No, wait, it's...
Impact Partners. Yes. You want us to say something really quick about it?
I want to get them on. I want to do a segment on the Impact.
Yeah, no,
they would be so great.
In a heartbeat.
Yeah, right? Yeah. You can just see.
I can give you a...
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I must have it too. But I just I got to get that. I know.
Can I say something really quick about them?
Impact Partners. Yeah, we're on.
So Impact Partners was the main.
And then we'll wind it up.
Impact Partners was the main power behind funding this film. And to their credit, like I said, we went into this film kind of wanting to shame the hunting world. And
oh, that's funny.
We were very anti. But we decided to give it a fair shake. And I think to the credit of Impact, they got a rough cut that is quite different from the film we set out originally to do. And I think many people as investors would say, less marketable.
Right.
That's complex. We didn't sign up for that.
It's hard to market that.
And kudos to Dan and Jenny and everybody at Impact for saying, this is a wonderful surprise. It dares be really a mindfuck of a film, and that's what we're after, good journalism, and they never tried to persuade us to make it one way or another, and I think not every investor would do that, so hats off to them.
Great, yeah. Well, we'll have to get them on, too. By the way, can't say mind on this show, thank you, guys. Christina, Shaul, appreciate it very much.
Six.
So young and wheeling. Move down to Scottsdale. Where the hell am I? Hey, 19.
No, we can't dance together.
We can't dance together.
No, we can't talk at all.
Please take me along when you slide on down. Hey, 19. That's Aretha Franklin. She don't.
You know, I kind of still feel, even after I've seen the film and I've spoken to the filmmakers, I still have my feelings about what I, you know, that I went in essentially feeling. But I certainly can't talk about those things, whether it's hunting and conservation, quite in the same way anymore, because there's much more nuance, you know, to it than I knew and or gave credit to. And that is why one goes out to see documentaries or films in general. And for those who are a little wary of the advocacy documentary or the issue documentary, this is, yes, it's around an issue, I suppose. But what it's doing is it's adding dimension to what there should be. Because the best documentaries that are built around a particular issue, whether it's the environment, whether it's bloodshed or war or what have you, or disease or some other political issue, the best ones always show you the complex nature. The ones that rub us or maybe a bit the wrong way are those documentaries that simplify and are reductive. And those don't really do much more than pray, you know, sing to the choir. Right. And that's a major thing going on in our world today, is that most of the people that hear us are those who are already on our team. And we need to be reaching the other teams a bit more effectively. So it's a good documentary. School Life is also a good documentary. It's not an issue documentary. It's not really even about education. It's a little bit about education, but it's also about more. It's about what is a family. And here is a version of a family. I have family, as many of my regular listeners know. I have, of course, my own family, but I've also have my camp family that was very important, and which definitely had an enormous impact on how I turned out and on my values. And I think that what these filmmakers that are coming up, they're both, it's an Irish couple. They're married. Their name is Nasan Keenan and David Rain, and they have made a film very much about family. And what is life like when you're going to a preparatory school in the middle of rural Ireland and you're many miles away from family and you get to know these people intimately and that you grew up with them? And what is that experience like? So the film centers on a couple that have been at the school for many decades, in fact, met, I believe, and got married, having met at the school as being part of the faculty. And are now the sort of our navigators in this film called School Life. Let's talk to those filmmakers, and then we'll be back after that.
I never seen you looking so bad, my funky one. You tell me that your super fine mind has come undone. Any major dude with half a heart surely will tell you, my friend. Any minor world that breaks apart falls together again. When the demon is at your door, in the morning it won't be there no more. Any major dude will tell you.
Good morning, everybody. Sit down, please. Welcome back to most of you, but we have a new welcome for a few faces.
Well, that is 52, that is 52. You know what means isosceles?
Shh! If you want to change the world, you start doing it yourself.
Oh, I like that book. Oh, that's my favorite. I love it.
He's a bright pupil if it's explained to him more than once.
I don't want her to live her life where she stands 5 yards back from what everybody else is doing when she's got such a lot to offer. She's very clever.
Thank you. good. For event when it comes, remember me.
That actually wasn't too bad.
Yes.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about was same-sex marriage.
Sometimes it's better to be gay than to be single.
You did play some very good rugby. And if you play like that today, you'll have no problem. Nobody makes a mistake on purpose. You know when you've made a mistake. What you need is rest for your teammates to come and support you.
Well, go on. Impress me.
Okay, well, it is a privilege. I'm sitting here with the filmmakers, the co-directors, is that safe to say? David Rain and Nasa Nahinan, who are both in from Ireland, okay, who have co-directed this wonderful documentary called School Life. It is it's a verite film. We call it verite because there's no narration. You're providing a window into this small Irish school, prep school, preparatory.
Yeah.
What town is it in Ireland, first of all?
It's just outside Kells in County Meath.
Okay.
Where the Book of Kells comes from.
Oh, that book. I read that when I was in grammar school. I'm sure you want to know that it's one of my biggest, so far, regrets that I've not been to Ireland. You get that a lot?
Yeah.
Do you, actually? Do people actually start talking
about it? Some people don't even know where it is, so, you know, it fluctuates.
Oh, and they...
Knowing it, and then people...
And they've watched your film. They don't know where Ireland is.
No, Nelson means like a taxi driver who's not sure where Ireland is, but then another taxi driver who's going next month because he's always wanted to go to Ireland. So you get a very mixed reaction when you say you're from Ireland.
I see, yeah. It's just slightly exotic, I guess, to maybe some of us here in the States. Well, I've been all over otherwise. Scotland, England, you know, and then...
Okay, so you've been close.
Yeah. Oh, very close.
You
yeah,
there's it no. Won't be a culture shock.
I'm just digging myself further in because it's I have fewer excuses. Yeah, and I don't want to go back. I mean, I would prefer to go to Ireland, but I just haven't had the enough reason to. I guess other than pure desire. And after watching School Life, it was only brought back in full force because it just looks. Everybody seems just so thoughtful and I don't know, charming, wry. Intelligent. I don't know. Maybe we're in a very isolated situation with this particular school and the faculty there. But these teachers, what's the name of the school, David, again?
Remember? It's called Hetford.
Hetford. They just all seem so well. they just seem rested enough or motivated.
They're
or
vocational teachers.
Enough. Yeah,
they're teachers who've been there a long time, made a real commitment to teaching, and you know haven't just gone. Okay, teaching sounds cool. We get long holidays, short days. These are teachers who've been there. John and Amanda, the main characters of the film, have been there 46 years while we were filming. Now 48, 49.
They're
years.
They're still there.
They're still teaching. They don't hit retirement age and go great pension. They love it, and they love the children. They love being there. So that's what I mean by vocational there. It is a different way of approaching teaching and being with children. And that's why it seems almost too perfect. But their compassion for the kids, their way of handling difficult situations is something that comes from years and years and years of doing it, but enjoying doing it and you know really loving doing it.
And understanding that they've got these kids at this particular time in the kid's life, this children's life, that, you know, where they really are fertilizing so much. It's such an important time, you know. So that weight of that seems not lost on your characters, on your subjects.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's their childhood. You know, they start at the school at the age of 7 and they leave at 13, you know,
before
the hormones all kick in and yeah. Horrible teen years happen.
Fortunate for them, yeah.
Yeah, so this is the period of their lives that they get them and that they just, you know, switch on the light bulbs and it's really quite extraordinary to see what happens.
Yeah, it all does happen in those years, doesn't it? Your values and your priorities, et cetera, seem to really be entrenched at that period of time. I guess I'm reminded of that period, too, when I went to this very left-wing summer camp here in New York State. And my parents, but between those two spheres, those two entities. You know, I am who I am all these years later, still from those that time of mm-hmm. 7 to 13. The lead, your lead couple, this married couple, their names again are
John and Amanda Layden. They met at the school. They started it 46 years ago. Love. Fell in love, got married, and they've been living on the school grounds ever since.
It's their world.
Wow. It's totally their world. And they live in the woods, which is right next to the school. So, you know, they're a stone's throw away from the school. And they had three children themselves. And they decided to send their children to the local primary school, not to Hedford, partly because they didn't want to teach them. They thought it's not right that two parents teaching in a school would end up teaching their own three children, but also because they wanted their children to have a social life in the local community and have friends in the local community. Because the nature of a boarding school is you come, you're there for the year or 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, but you're only there during term time, holiday time, you're gone. Back, you could be living in another country, you could be living on the other side of Ireland. So friendships are a little bit harder to form. Or the friendships that form, they last much longer outside of the school, after the school. But, you know, during holiday time, you don't see your friends.
So. Right. I can see it's a double-edged sword, or there's advantages to both options.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
but
going locally is very important. I can see that. But also the relationships you form at Hedford seem like really special.
They are. I mean, we were always interested. I mean, that was a question, a fundamental question when we started this film was, is there such a thing as a surrogate family? And that's what we found in the school, that actually, yes, there is.
Yeah.
Because when we were researching the project, we spoke to alumni who had been to the school, so 50-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 30-year-olds, and we asked them all what their experience at Hedford was like. And John and Amanda Layden's name kept coming up, and they really did leave their mark on these children. And, you know, there's a well-worn path to their house as well. Like any weekend you go there, there's usually somebody sitting there having lunch with them. The younger ones, the 20-year-olds, come and stay for the weekend.
Oh, right. Of course, they have 50 years of
kids.
This extended family, as you described. Mm. Yeah, there is something about that. Even in the teachers, well, I have more of a parallel to that summer camp I keep remembering, because we're still also 50 years later, 40 years later, in touch, still like a family almost. But I even feel kind of protective of teachers that I had growing up, you know, even if they weren't all my favorites. So with this, it seems even that much more intensified because of the nature of the school and the length of the time that all these people stay together through that period, you know. I'm going to ask the most over-asked question, which is how you met John and Amanda Layden. Did you have a personal relationship?
Well, we found the school first. We were looking for a school for our own children.
But it makes a lot of sense then.
Yeah, and so we found the school, and we met the headmaster, and he'd seen some of our previous work.
But just by happenstance?
Yeah, well,
you're big deal documentary filmmakers.
In a small pool. It's a big fish in a small pool.
Right.
No, we're not even big fish, but we have made three or four feature docs that have done well internationally. They've toured the world in festivals and sold to some international broadcasters. So Dermot had seen some of our work and knew our work, and so he was open to the idea of a film about the school. And we both went to boarding school. So it was kind of like, oh, hang on a minute, this is interesting. I did not have a great experience in boarding school. I was 7 years old, like some of the children in Hedford. My parents lived in Nigeria, and they sent me back to the UK to boarding school.
That's hard.
It is, yeah, at that age. I mean, it was partly because the Biafran War was starting, so it was not a particularly safe place to live, and partly because the company my dad worked for were willing to pay for a private school in the UK. So, but at seven, it's too young.
It is
to be separated at that for that length of time from your parents. So I didn't find it easy.
Yeah,
my older brother was 11, and he found it easy. He liked it. And Nasa, her experience was also at 11, and she had a good time. So it's a part of boarding school is about the age that children go. But we were both really, really interested in what a 21st century boarding school would be like. Had it changed? And we looked at Hedford as a surrogate family. So we had this idea that, you know, could other people, teachers, matrons, groundspeople, people who caretakers, could they could they care? Could they step in as in place of parents and care for the children the way that the parents who are not there could? And that, so that was kind of the lead, the first question that we went into this film with.
You mentioned even caretakers. It does seem like they form their attachments to even the grounds. Keepers,
yeah, well,
and
they're 24/7, you know,
right,
for
right, no, I understand
7 days a week. So.
But they're also sensitive people. I mean, in the very small snapshot that we meet toward the end, one of them, it was like, oh, it's an experience that you don't necessarily. But I would relate that to the summer camp experience, where you do get to know the people that just sort of come in and maybe help with certain parts of the grounds and things like that, as opposed to like in a typical public school situation here, where that might not be quite so common. It still happens, but it's a very unique school. So did your kids end up going to the Hedford?
Our kids actually went to the school as day pupils, because we moved. We were living 4.5 hours away.
Oh.
And we lived in rural Ireland in Donegal. Uh-huh. And we decided to move down, and the logical thing was for the children while we were filming. We it was just us. It was NASA doing camera and me doing sound, and we were embedded, to use that weird term, embedded in the school. We had the school gave us a room to keep our equipment and to have cups of tea in. So we went to school every day. So it made sense for our children to go as day pupils. They didn't board in the school. They came home
right.
with
well,
us.
Well, there were other kids, too. Were there not? Or they were almost everybody else
pretty
there?
Pretty much, yeah. Most
talking
of the,
to the mic.
Yeah, most of the children in the school are boarders. There was probably about 7%, would you say? 10% would be day pupils.
Oh, okay.
But even a day pupil, they start their school day at 8:30 in the morning or 8:30 in the morning, and then they can stay up until 8 in the evening time. And most of the kids, they can leave after 6, but most of the kids choose to stay a little longer because they want to get involved in the band room or, you know, sports or something else that happens after school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess maybe I'm just remembering the parents maybe at the end when they picked up their kids as well. How long was that period that you were at the school then?
So
were you there for a full academic?
Yeah, we filmed there. Yeah, what you see. What you see in the film is a full academic year. We did film for 2 years, but we ended up using the footage from the first year to raise the funding for the film, because at that time nobody was interested in a film about a school. So we had written these very private school, but. We had written these very detailed treatments of what the film would be, but I think people, they're a bit more skeptical now, and they don't really believe you until they actually see some footage. So just for coherence sake, we decided to structure the storytelling on 1 year, so that the footage is all from the second year.
Mm-hmm. The film, again, is called School Life, and it is going to be distributed by Magnolia, which is a very nice, I think, pairing for your partnership for the film. And it did already have a theatrical in Ireland? I assume it did, because you finished in 2015, right?
We finished filming in 2015, September,
okay.
June 2015, but we edited for a year. So,
oh, right. You must have had quite a bit of
footage. We had a lot of
footage. Of course, yeah.
So we had a full year of editing.
Yeah, while you were saying, I mean, what kind of filmmakers... Because this is very much... A verite, I'm going to keep using that term. There's various terms to describe where the documentary filmmakers are fly on the wall, essentially. You know, how much were you really, and were you editing as you went along, in the sense of not literally editing in the editing room, but were you editing in the sense of like what was going to be used, making notes, and I mean, how do you handle the potential for the hundreds and hundreds of hours that you could end up with?
Because we'd been there, we had a year of research, getting to know the teachers and the families and the children. And then that first year of filming, we got to know the rituals of the school, the routines, and we got to understand how different teachers worked and when were good times and bad times to film. So in terms of structuring it as observational filmmakers, we were there a lot. I mean, we as I said, we went to school every day, but we filmed probably 3 days a week, sometimes till late in the evening. And we had a sense, well, we knew that John and Amanda were going to be major characters, and Dermot Dix, the headmaster, who's quite an inspirational teacher. So we did spend more time with them. And so the storylines started emerging through being with them, and their class groups didn't change. So we started seeing different children within their class groups, and not really following children in their classes, but being aware as filmmakers of the presence of potential storylines. But we left the actual decision on the kids' storylines till the edit. And we didn't edit as we went along. We were exhausted from filming.
Sure,
all day.
It makes sense. I understand, unless you had an editor on your immediate team, and you didn't.
No,
so.
And we were parents. We had to go home and be parents every evening and weekend. Mm-hmm. So
I don't understand that, but go ahead.
I'll explain later.
Yeah. Wait a minute, I have a child. I interrupted you because I didn't want to forget to talk about this aspect of making such a type of film, but... To go back to right before I asked about the editing, I was talking to you about whether or not you had a theatrical in Ireland yet.
We had a premiere in Dublin Film Festival,
okay,
which was sold out, and so we decided to do a small theatrical release there. It ran really well in the Art House Cinema in Dublin,
right?
And it didn't run so well in the Omniplex because it had its original title, which was in
Multiplex in English,
Multiplex in America,
yeah.
Because the original title was in Loco Parentis, which is Latin.
Oh yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah, it was in Sundance as
in
Loco Parentis.
It's an anti-marketing. It's like someone with marketing, good marketing skills might have said, don't use a Latin title
for a film. Because
for a film about education, a documentary about education.
Exactly. You know, educationalists love it, but right. The general public go, is that a foreign language film? Is that Spanish? Or are we going to have to read subtitles?
Our son said, Mom, why did you call it in Loco Parentis? Now they're going to think it's called Crazy Parents. because
of the Spanish.
Loco,
Spanish.
Yeah. Loco, right. That's funny.
Yeah, but like we under its new title, we showed it at a film festival there 2 weeks ago in Ireland, and we had two screenings, and it had played in the local cinema as well, mm-hmm. And so we thought, well, you know, probably everybody's seen it now.
Right.
We had to put on two more screenings. We sold out four screenings.
That's good.
So it was great. Yeah,
so yeah.
I think it's
problem.
A word of mouth film. I think, you know, it's a film that if you see, people start talking about it, and it kind of touches them because it's quite poignant as well as being a fun film, but it's actually, you know, there's a poignancy to this kind of reflection on childhood and on a particular type of childhood. Mm-hmm. So, and I think people sort of recognize that in it.
It's one of those rare beasts in the documentary world, a film that actually makes you feel good at the end of it.
Yeah, right.
Rather than a documentary that challenges you and makes you think, God, this planet is a mess and this world is a mess and how can we fix it? This film makes you feel optimistic and hopeful, and it makes you laugh and maybe even cry. Did you cry?
No. I believe, I'm a stone-hearted type of guy,
yeah.
So, you know.
You got a little lump in the throat,
Yeah, it takes a lot more than that. Actually, I cry at it doesn't take very much at all, actually, normally. But yes, the ending was very, very moving. Because I'll tell you why. Because most of the kids I see are kids, in, you know, my purview are kids that are real kids. I mean, they're just running around playing. All they want to do is play video games now, look at their phones, you know, maybe play some sports, pick on each other, make silly jokes. I don't have as much exposure seeing kids in more sophisticated kids in a more sophisticated environment like you might at a private school. This is drawing no distinction or opinion about either. But when you see these kids, they're so thoughtful most of the time. I mean, you show many sides of the kids. I don't want to suggest otherwise. But at the end, they're just, you know, kids who are like, you know, sad and crying because they're leaving these adults that they love and each other, and it's they just need hugs, and you know, it's very moving to see. So yeah, that touched me. Yeah,
good.
I don't remember crying, but maybe I and it opens here in New York, right? And is it opening in other cities on September 8th, I think.
Is it the eighth?
Nine theaters or nine cities?
Nine cities. But it'll open in 15 in total. Well, maybe more, depending on
how
well received it is.
Right.
But it opens in New York on the 8th.
The 8th of September.
In the IFC.
At the IFC Center downtown. And Yeah, so go check out the school life at the IFC Center on September 8th, which is probably when this comes out, will be in a couple of days from when people hear this, because I'll post this like just before the 8th.
Oh, do.
Yeah. Please, yeah. So that week of Labor Day.
Your audience won't regret it. They won't regret going to see the film.
Oh, no. No. And they can trust in me. My regular listeners hopefully will at least help fill up some of the screenings, I hope. The ones that live in New York, anyway. And it's going to be in Los Angeles, I assume?
It opens in Los Angeles a week later, and then...
Oh, okay.
All
and then wide.
Boston and Oklahoma and...
Everywhere where schools...
Portland.
And, oh, it's great.
That's it.
Not Chicago. We don't want to do that. Thank you, David and NASA. It's a pleasure. I hope to have you back on with another project. You know, it'd be a pleasure.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. In a few days, I keep saying this, but it's actually coming up soon. I've just been waiting for a couple of things to launch my Kickstarter campaign in just a couple more days. One is the pitch video, which is in the hands of a filmmaker right now, putting that together. The second thing is I'm getting my rewards together. If you're listening to this and you have great ideas for rewards for my campaign, please get in touch with me as fast as you can. You can contact me at adam@filmwax.com or on Facebook or Twitter or what have you. It's very easy to find me. And please, if you do, I will be forever indebted, and certainly thank you on the show and whatever else I can do to support you and what you do, because you're, after all, doing that so generously to me in the hypothetical at this moment, in the abstract. But let's make it concrete. Send me your thoughts and ideas. And then for those who listen to the show or think other people might be interested in the show, please do support what I'm doing by either contributing, because I want to be even more effective in my own issue-driven agenda, which is to further effectively champion independent film. And that's what the campaign is, in a nutshell, what it's going to be about. It's about replacing equipment. It's about being able to travel. It's about being able to take on some clients and help certain films that are on my radar and much more, hire people when necessary. I can't do a lot of that now, and it limits my reach. It limits my ability to help particular filmmakers, and I know I can do much more. So that, that's the broad strokes, and that's what the film. So please do contribute what you can or share the campaign when it goes live in a few days. I thought it was going to be up a couple of days ago, but it looks like it'll be either, it's going to be after the weekend, I have a feeling. So that's that. That's my pitch right there. In the meantime, you could do all the following. You can, of course, like I always ask, go to iTunes, put a review and a star rating on our page. You can sign up on our Facebook page or follow us and like us and on Twitter and on Instagram. It's very easy to find the show. And, if you can find the show itself very easily on the Rooftop Films website. You can find it on iTunes. You can find it on Stitcher. You can find it on YouTube. And, the beauty part is once we have some more resources available to the show, I'm going to be able to put it on a bunch more spots, too. So it'll just become more and more ubiquitous, a podcast. And we'll be able to do more live podcasts and much more. So thank you very much for that. And please just continue to look out for that, this Kickstarter. So hopefully by Monday, if not sooner, with that. I just got off of a long conversation. I just finished a long conversation with Crispin Glover. So that's coming up. very shortly. In fact, it's probably the next episode. An hour plus long with Crispin Glover and what he's up to these days. What a perfect guest he turned out to be. And I've got about 10 more shows all lined up here. That's how busy I've been. And I've got a bunch more in the pipeline, scheduled. Amazing conversations. So do continue to listen to the podcast, Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Thank you so much. And remember to take care of yourself and the ones you love.